This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, January 19th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. For the fourth time since October, the country is facing a government shutdown. The Republican Congress has again failed to reach a compromise with Democrats on the budget for 2018. Yet, despite these struggles with basic governance, the Republican Party has made significant progress on achieving its longstanding goals, including tax reform, anti-regulatory reforms, and legislation designed to destabilize the Affordable Care Act. In an interview with C-SPAN last week, Paul Ryan had this to say.
What I'm excited about, we ran on a very specific agenda in 2016, and we came around, we all got consensus on what that agenda, we called it the better way. And now we're in the middle of executing.
John Cassidy joins me to discuss what the administration and the Republican Congress are accomplishing amid the chaos. Hi, John.
Hi, Dorothy.
Trump will be celebrating his first anniversary in office this weekend at Mar-a-Lago with a big fundraiser. While Republicans are desperately trying to avoid this shutdown, one point of contention is funding the health care of 9 million children. So let's start by having you quickly review how Trump could have avoided this debacle.
Well, the funding side of it has been going on for months now. Then there's the immigration side of it, which you'll remember there was a famous meeting back in September between Trump and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, which it looked like they'd reached a deal, or they emerged to say they'd reached a deal on DACA, which is the Obama-era program which gave legal protections to undocumented immigrants who came here as minors, basically people who were brought in by their parents when they were kids. There, at least in theory, is bipartisan support for the idea of extending legal protections for them. But the Trump administration, for political reasons, said they were going to end these protections back on Labor Day. And since then, the two parties have supposed to have been reaching an agreement on how to extend the protections for the Dreamers. And also, Trump is demanding, obviously, funding for his wall. And also some other changes to the immigration laws, including the lottery system to legal immigration. So what's happened basically is the long-running row over immigration has got mixed up with a long-running dysfunction over funding the government. And basically the Republicans tried to do another short-term funding fix, which didn't include an immigration fix.
But it did include this CHIP program, and that's where the kids come in.
Exactly. That's a third issue which has been out there for a long time. CHIP is the children's version of Medicaid, very popular program, very effective program, which insures between 6 and 8 million poor children who otherwise wouldn't have health insurance. Again, the Republicans supposedly say they're in favor of extending that funding, but they've been using it as a bargaining chip. The Republicans have said, no, we're not going to do a DACA fix now, but we will extend CHIP funding for 6 years. That was their sort of bone they threw to the Democrats. And so it's all come down to today, Friday, where we still haven't got an agreement, and both sides are standing their ground, or so it seems. We're going to have another 12 hours of theater drama on the Hill, and there will be a vote. In the Senate, looks like Republicans don't have the votes at the moment to pass through this temporary funding bill, which would basically just put things off for a month. And if the vote goes against the Republicans, then the government will, or large parts of it, will shut down tomorrow, and we'll be back to 2013, and who knows what will happen then.
And so going back to 2013, what is different this time? As I understand it, Democrats are withholding votes now in pursuit of goals that are embraced by both parties.
In 2013, it was perfectly clear that the Republicans were responsible for it, Ted Cruz above all else, as any sort of crusade against the Affordable Care Act. And the Republicans were, you know, suffered badly in the polls after that. So it was a disaster for the Republicans, really. The Obama administration quickly realized that they were on the good side of it politically. They didn't rush once the government had shut to, get things going again, because they knew it was rebounding against the Republicans. And it was widely regarded as a disaster for the Republican Party. Mitch McConnell himself said, you know, we should never do that again. Now, if the government does shut down, the next few weeks are going to be basically about a big political battle about who was to blame. Republicans are going to say, look, we had a temporary funding bill. The immigration fix didn't have to be done now. The deadline is the start of March, not the start of February. And that the Democrats are basically shutting down the government for an issue which hasn't got anything to do with funding the government. The Democrats are going to say, no, this was the Republicans' fault. You control all three branches of government, the White House, the Senate, the Congress. You can't do a basic thing like fund the government. You agreed to this DACA fix 6 months ago. You've been reneging on it. Trump's reneged on it. There was a bipartisan agreement between Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham, the two senators, which they presented at the White House last week. Trump rejected it, threw it out, said he's not going to accept that. So this is basically a Republican internal problem. You can't agree on your DACA fix, so it's all your fault. That's going to be the political battle, assuming there isn't a last-minute settlement today.
So let's talk about the Trump paradox. Trump turns out to be a really terrible dealmaker from what we've seen so far. He's the most unpopular president in memory. He opposes policies that a majority of Americans support, and he supports ones that most Americans deplore. And he weakens his own party with his endlessly contradictory tweets and racist remarks. Yet, the stock market continues to rise. Unemployment is down. He's appointed Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. How does he do it?
The way I look at this, Dorothy, is that there are basically two administrations. There's the circus at the White House, which goes on every day, and, you know, Trump's in the middle of it, chaotic president, terrible public approval ratings, widely thought to be way out of his depth and not really knowing anything at all about policy. And almost all the media coverage focuses on that on a day-to-day basis because, A, it's an incredible story having Donald Trump as president, and, B, it drives the ratings. So the networks, cable networks, broadcast networks, even most of the print media spend most of their time covering the White House. I think that sort of basically ignores the other Trump administration, which is all the rest of partly what's happening on Capitol Hill, but also what's happening in the various departments, the sort of administrative Trump administration, you might call it, which slowly but surely has been getting all its appointees in place and pushing through, I wouldn't call them Trump policies, more sort of old-fashioned or new-fashioned Republican policies, sort of policies that go back to the sort of Paul Ryan Heritage Foundation, Koch brothers agenda of stripping back the government, getting rid of regulations, lowering taxes, attacking the Affordable Care Act. If you use that as your metric, you know, they've had more success than most people give them credit for, I think. I mean, obviously, the tax cuts, the big tax cut bill is the most prominent example of that. But even on a day-to-day basis, there are lots of things going on which don't get much coverage. I wrote about some of them the other day. I mean, just take the last week, for example. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that's CMS, the agency which runs Medicaid, Medicare, they've announced that from now on, states, if they want to, can impose work requirements on people who are eligible for Medicaid. Once you impose work requirements and things like charges, there's lots of studies showing that for whatever reason, a lot of people just drop off the rolls. They can't get it together to get proper letters from their doctors, etc. They can't afford the small premiums. I mean, the people who tend to be eligible for Medicaid on Medicaid, you know, are sort of poor, marginalized people. A lot of them are ill, have illnesses. A lot of them are sort of taking care of sick relatives, etc. These are not members of society who interact well with government bureaucracies making, you know, onerous requirements of them. Now, the argument the Republicans are making is we want to get people back into the workforce. You know, that helps their long-term prosperity and their health. So I think the Medicaid changes are largely driven by ideology. Then another example, the Treasury Department, they're talking about relaxing the Community Reinvestment Act. You've got the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Elizabeth Warren's creation. They just announced this week, it's now run by Mick Mulvaney, the Office Management Budget Director. And he once referred to the new agency, as a sick joke. You can basically go all across the departments. You look at the FCC, for example, you know, it's getting rid of net neutrality. The EPA, you know, ended the Obama administration's so-called war on coal. Lincoln Interiors opening the coastal lands to drilling, including parts of the Anwer Refuge in Alaska. DOJ, you mentioned, not just appointing, you know, not just Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, but they're appointing conservative justices to lower courts, you know, every day of the week, basically. National Labor Relations Board, they've appointed pro-business appointees. So the administrative state, the deep state, as Steve Bannon would call it, is now in Republican hands, and they're, you know, going ahead with the agenda which Paul Ryan has had for years.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So this brings us to the frustrations that the Democrats must be feeling every day. So just taking the tax bill alone, you know, just about every reputable economist projects that the tax bill is going to hurt poor and middle-class Americans. But the bill is gaining in popularity. You've talked about how the media jumps on the tweets and everything else. How do the Democrats effectively battle Trump and the Republicans?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think as far as the midterms go, they've probably, from a cynical perspective, got the right policy, which is just to focus on Trump. The big weakness of the Trump administration, obviously, is Trump himself. He's very popular with his base, and he's very unpopular with basically everybody else. His base is not 50% of the population, so if you can turn the people who don't like it out on a voting day, you can defeat Republicans. Democrats are basically trying to turn the midterms into a referendum on Trump. Now, you can say that's what about some positive policies? Don't we need positive policies? I think they do, but I think that's more of a requirement going to 2020 rather than 2018. I mean, if you go back to 2010, for example, the Republicans did a very effective, again, very cynical, very effective job of turning that into a sort of referendum on Obama, G up their base, and they had enormous success. The raw materials are there for a very similar outcome this year. And things do seem to be going in the Democrats' favor if you just look at the sort of local elections. There were three or four local elections, state elections this week, for example, which showed a big swing against the Republicans compared to 2016, including a shocker in Wisconsin where a Republican held seat, which you know had a margin about 15-20%, went Democrat.
But then there's 2020. And well, I was thinking about this a little bit this week. Did you read the letters in the New York Times from Trump supporters?
I haven't read them all. I mean, I did read some of them, yes.
You know, it was pretty interesting because these were not the voters, really, that Hillary Clinton called deplorables. They were pretty reasonable. One of them, he says, President Trump has exceeded my wildest expectations. Yes, he's embarrassing. Yes, he picks unnecessary fights. But he also pushed tax reform through, has largely defeated ISIS in Iraq, has named a number of solid conservative judges, as you pointed out, has prioritized American citizens over illegal immigrants, and so on and on and on. So you may disagree with that writer, that voter, but on Trump's voters' terms, he is succeeding.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, that's why his approval rating back to 40%. It occasionally bounces down to 35, never seems to go below 35, never seems to go much above 40. They are the Trump voters. I mean, he got it up to 46 somehow in the general election. I mean, the ISIS thing, I think, is important, although it doesn't get covered that much. That's seen as a big win in Trump Republican circles. Tax reform, cutting taxes is always popular. And the way that it's a very cynical tax bill. Basically, there are tax cuts in the early years for everybody, and then they'll be gradually, you know, withdrawn. But by then, Trump will be out of the White House. The immigration issue is obviously a big one. I mean, that was Trump's biggest issue, I think. His build a wall rhetoric, obviously, was treated very scathingly in the media, but it resonated. The polls show most Americans agree with it. If you're a Trump voter, you're happy with what Trump has done on immigration. Now, the question is, you know, are there enough of those people to win elections. And at the moment, it doesn't look like they are.
Well, it didn't look that way for 2016 either.
Obviously, but we've had some actual election. You know, the Republican, even Paul Ryan himself said last week, he's from Wisconsin, he said, you know, we need to be worried about this. We need to take on board what's happening. I think that's one of the reasons, actually, that the Republicans are keen on engineering a showdown, because they think that might sort of change the political dynamic and political narrative in Washington. If they can blame the shutdown on the Democrats, they might be able to sort of, you know, change things a bit. It does seem like McConnell and Ryan believe that this is going to rebound in their favor, because they basically seem to have set this up to have a showdown.
And do you think the wiser strategy for 2020 is there's going to be a lot of pressure for Democrats to become the populists of the left, although the tendency normally in a presidential election is to move back to the center?
Now, I think populism is definitely the way to go. I mean, you know, the question is, you know, rising from the Hillary defeat, obviously, is what do you do about the Wisconsins and the Michigans and the Pennsylvanias and the Ohios? Would Bernie Sanders, with his economic populism message, have been able to appeal more to those voters? So do you need a Democrat who's willing to reach out to those, and how should he do it?
Well, you can see Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren and others beginning to lay down their markers.
They are. Or, you know, should you double down on the sort of Obama coalition strategy, appealing to educated voters, minorities, you know, basically just win a few more votes than Hillary did, and you know, and she obviously won the popular vote by a large margin. If you just do a bit better in a few of these states, you know, she'd have been the president. I think there'll certainly be a big push from the left, from the sort of, well, you know, looks like Elizabeth Warren may well be run, looks like Bernie Sanders may run again. You know, they, I would say, in among the sort of Democratic supporters, they're probably the two most popular figures in the party. And then I don't think there will be a sort of old-fashioned, you know, Bill Clinton, DLC type candidate. I think the party's gone past that, but you may get a more sort of centrist populist, sort of running on the sort of
Gillibrand
type, you know, Sherrod Brown type, type ticket, Cory Booker. But I don't think any candidate who doesn't run on a explicitly populist line is going to have much chance at all.
Thanks so much, John.
Thank you.
John Cassidy is a staff writer and a political columnist for NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Wilentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.